Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Christopher Farina holds a doctorate in linguistics from the University of South Carolina. He has over 10 years of experience across a wide range of functions in qualitative and quantitative research in applied linguistics and in the social sciences. He is currently Associate Director, Listening and Linguistics at InVibe Labs, a voice research company that works with healthcare organizations. Topics discussed include historical linguistics, pre-med, business writing, discourse analysis, conversational analysis, interviewing, professionalizing, work environments, PowerPoint, mentoring, and medical communication. Links to Christopher's LinkedIn profile and other resources mentioned are in the show notes. Today, I would like to welcome Christopher Farina to the podcast. He was one of our moderators at LCL 2024 and has had a really interesting career in what we are loosely calling medical communication, but he's going to talk all about that. So Christopher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Laurel. It is my absolute pleasure to be here.
So we will start with the question I ask everybody. How did you find out what linguistics was and then decide you were actually going to get a PhD in it?
Yeah, this is a really hard question. Because
okay.
I think like a lot of guests that I can remember, I didn't really hear about linguistics. I discovered it. I was in undergrad, I was a classics major, which means that I took a lot of Latin and Greek. Mm-hmm. And as part of my undergraduate thesis for that program, I kind of stumbled into historical linguistics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my goodness, language change and how Latin grew into all of these Romance dialects and how Latin and Greek interacted via, you know, the conquest of what became the Eastern Roman Empire, like that whole Greek-speaking world.
Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated by the intersection of history and culture and how those affected language. And I ended up writing one of my earlier pieces of like semi-academic work on it. And after that point, I'm like, you know, I bet this is a whole area of study.
Uh-huh.
And I should probably learn more about it and look into it, because I would bet that I didn't do a very good job since I really don't know what I'm doing and I'm kind of just discovering it. So I spent the next couple years after I completed my undergrad just reading linguistics textbooks, trying to get a sense of what this field was, how people are currently using it, the different subfields that people can actually go into, some of the more practical work. Like this is when I was first exposed to like legal like linguistic anthropology, mm-hmm. medical linguistic anthropology, and kind of understanding what some of the applications for this are. And I ended up deciding based on that, you know, I could probably go back to school for this and spend at least two more years learning about this subject. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 7 years later, I ended up with a couple extra degrees and just uh-huh. never really looked back after that weird, you know, serendipitous, yeah, this is a fun thing I can write an undergraduate thesis on.
Yeah. So was your focus during your PhD on historical linguistics still?
My master's was in historical linguistics.
Okay.
And I kept the very similar focus of language change in the greater Romance languages. But I very quickly lost sight of that as, you know, my net goal. And I really felt that way for practical reasons more than anything else. Like I love the area of study. I think it's got all of the right balance of history and sociology and the things that I love about social sciences, that you're studying people and you're mm-hmm. applying these schemes to them. But I made the decision practically. You know, I looked at the job market at the time and said, you know, one in 13 or so historical linguists who get a PhD are getting a job. Maybe I should look into one of the other things that I'm interested in if I want to pursue anything, let alone an academic career related to my field. So after my master's, I ended up switching to second language acquisition, which I did as kind of a second language acquisition and pedagogy or like teaching kind of path that we had at the University of South Carolina, where I did both degrees.
So as you're moving through the program and you've had this revelation that, oh, maybe I'm not going to get a job as a historical linguist, were you still thinking that you would stay in academia?
I think for the first 4 years or so that I spent in graduate school, I felt that an academic career was the career. And I think that's largely because I didn't have a lot of insight into alternatives. The University of South Carolina, more than a lot of others from the people that I talk to, really prioritizes a lot of career development training, professionalization. So like we had classes on writing resumes and converting your academic thesis statement to something that was more quote unquote normal people English. So you could deliver like an elevator presentation to anyone and, have described your entire thesis in 30 seconds. So I had a lot of those tools, but I wasn't really exposed to how to apply them or what other alternatives there were until I started critically investigating for myself and understanding, I don't necessarily like doing a lot of the work that is associated with this subfield in academia. Maybe there's something else out there for me. So at that time, I started engaging more with sources like the Linguist List. It's how I became connected with the Linguistics Beyond Academia Special Interest Group. And I really took it upon myself over the next 2 years to understand what other options were out there and explored those in a lot of depth, like a lot of informational interviews before I decided, back when I was an undergrad, I was also pre-med and I was pretty committed to that and really interested in basic science and how humans operate on a biological level. And then I shifted to how humans operate on a cultural and linguistic level. Maybe there's a way I can do both. And over the final year of my graduate school career, I really honed in on that. And I focused on that. I did a lot of soul searching and informational interviews in that in my final year in graduate school and while adjuncting. And that eventually led me to the course that I pursued. And I'm, I guess I'm 7-8 years in that career path now, and it's been wonderful, and I'm very grateful to have stumbled my way through it, just trying to tie all of the different interests that I've had throughout my adult life into a career that I would really enjoy.
Yeah, I think that's not unusual. From all the folks that I've spoken to, people manage to find a way to combine those other things, whether it's dance or music or journalism or, as you say, pre-med or law or whatever. Like, there's ways that you can bring it into linguistics, because of course linguistics is everything, right? It touches every single thing that we have as humans, because it's all about language and communication.
Yeah, it's hard to find a way for language to be absent.
Yeah, exactly. Although some people think it is, which is kind of weird, but that's a job that we still need to work on as far as educating the public. Someone that I was just talking said, and I think this is great, that linguistics has a marketing problem. I agree with that. It's something we need to work on.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. We have so many marketing problems.
We do. So one thing I did want to ask you about, just as a sidelight to this, it seems from looking at your LinkedIn profile, as you were making your way through graduate school, you were also working a lot. And this is something I'm sort of interested in exploring, because everybody's experiences in grad school was different. Some people worked a lot, some people didn't, because they either had financial support or they came from some resources. So can you talk a little bit about how the, you know, you're in school and you're working, but you're also now exploring this. Did that sort of shape your view on what work would be like for you when you finally got your PhD?
I think there are a couple areas where the answer is very much yes, and a couple where I think the association would be a lot harder to draw. I was fortunate early in my graduate school career to be exposed to, I guess it's like a business writing department. And I know such a thing exists, and I could not have been more privileged to work there, knowing now that I'm in healthcare communication.
Yeah.
And the tenets of good business communication are often the same ways that, you know, I have to convert my speech from, you know, the academic language that I was trained in to the more marketing, marketeering, market research, medical research kind of language that I have to use every day. Being exposed to all of those genres, being exposed to the different register and styles associated with business English, was a really important skills preparation for me. And it also just gave me a general idea of what working in an office environment was going to be like, because I had a couple office jobs before going back to graduate school, but none of them were in this language-focused, semi-creative space where you're working on a lot of internal self-guided kinds of initiatives that have an external audience. So you're not writing for yourself anymore. You're not writing for people like you. You're writing for people who think differently, who have completely different skill sets, different exposures, different educations and experiences. And you're always filtering to your audience. And that set of skills prepared me for, I think, everything else that I did in graduate school. I approached how I talked to students when I became a teaching assistant that way. I carried it into the experience that I had working in labs and teaching English as a second language. It was just a very fruitful way to think about audience awareness or the way that communication should always be listening-centric, especially when you're trying to convey information. That you as the speaker have to do all of the work. And although we're told that, and as linguists, we study the phenomenon of, you know, speaker-centric language and listener-centric language, it was really different to have a practicum in it my first couple of years in graduate school.
Yeah, like learning how, not just looking at it, but actually doing it and putting some work into it.
Yeah, exactly that. We have a saying that there's a huge difference between learning that and learning how. And this was my exposure into learning how. I am blessed to have had it so early in my graduate school career.
That is great. That what a great experience. I also wanted to just pick up on a thing that you said about learning how to work in an office. And this is something that the LCL has talked about a lot in terms of work environments, like figuring out what's going to work for you. And I think that just that piece of it, learning how to work in an office on a team, is always presented as a given. Like, you'll just know how to do this. But how could you know how to do it if you've never done it? It really is a cultural thing that you have to figure out, and every company is different. But it is definitely a huge part of your work life is just figuring out how to work with other people. I saw something online the other day and someone said, the best business advice I ever got was, it's better to be likable than to be a good employee. I was like, there's some truth in that, actually. Like, you know, it's not everything, but being likable is very important. Whatever that happens to mean within the group of people that you're working with, if people can't work with you, it's not going to, that's not the job for you. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. I believe the truth in that statement just stands for itself. Like when we're thinking of professionals in a business environment, you're really being evaluated in two separate capacities. Are you competent?
Mm-hmm.
And are you someone I want to work with?
Right, right.
And you really have to be both. And however they describe, you know, someone you want to work with, if it's fit, you know, cultural fit, business fit, personality match, like it's important to, as we're all, you know, looking at different career options, if you're, you know, fresh out of graduate school or considering what's next for you, fit is important. And you'll be with these people either physically next to them or virtually next to them for most of the hours you spend awake.
Exactly. More than your
really
family.
It's really important to like them. Yeah. Many more than your family, which is sad to say.
Yeah, it is, but all true. So this goes on for me on the list of the many things that they never tell you in graduate school about getting a job. Mm-hmm. Like, no one ever talks about this. Anyway, so following your journey, you were doing all this, you're doing informational interviews. Was there like an inciting incident that propelled you to finally go work at Verilog, I think, your first outside of academia job, or was it just kind of a gradual thing?
I'm not sure there was a propelling incident other than after about a year of job searching, mm-hmm. and probably 6 to 9 months of really applying like it's a part-time job.
Wow. Okay.
I was finally getting results from all of the submissions that I'd put out there, where at the time... It's hard to remember exactly how it went, but there were a lot of interviews that I was going through. This was not early in the stage of multi touch point interviewing, where, you know, you have interview phase one, you have interview phase two as you're going through these jobs. But I think on average, I probably had 3 or 4 interviews per job. That I was applying for and was fortunate enough to you know, get past that initial submission. And I just had a couple that all seemed really, really interesting come up in the area of healthcare communication.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with the one that I had the best feeling about. It wasn't at the time the one that was the most lucrative. It required me to move. It had a couple of things against it, but, you know, going back to that point of you spend a lot of time with these people and you spend a lot of time doing this, it was the one that I felt would be the most fun and the least like work. Like it was going to be the most interesting. I was going to learn so much. And it was the one I was most excited about. And it was just time, I guess. Like everything that I had been preparing for slowly came together, and I made the choice.
I really love what you were just saying about looking for a job being a job, because it is when you're in that phase and having to do the work, and the work is applying, sending your resume out, spending your time doing the interviews, right? Like it's not just the hour that you spend with the interviewer, but it's all the prep time ahead of time and then following up afterwards and providing more information. It's pretty intense. So when you were offered this position, did you negotiate? I'm sorry, I'm getting into the nitty gritty of it, but I'm just curious, like you did all these interviews, you were going to take this chance. It sounded like fun, always a plus.
Yes.
Yeah. Was there negotiation about like your salary? You don't have to name numbers if you don't want to, but I'm just curious about the practical aspects of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I am also very, very fortunate in my graduate school experiences as part of all of that professionalization training that my graduate school offered. They also included things like, how do you actually get a job? What happens at the tail ends of your interviews when you're starting to negotiate for your salary, or in this case, a moving stipend, or
right,
you know,
right.
the the different benefits that are negotiable versus the ones that are not. And yes, I very much did negotiate. It was not a high point in the market, so there was not a lot of flexibility. Mm-hmm. And mental math is not always my strong suit. But I believe that I got about 10% higher than I was originally offered. And I was also able to negotiate some things like, I think they had something like a year-long waiting period until you're able to get some of the benefits. And I was mm-hmm. able to request 6 months instead. Just a couple of small things that made it an overall like higher compensation package.
Yeah, I would not call those small things. That sounds like you did really well with your negotiations. I mean, the difference between 6 months and a year for benefits, that's significant.
It ended up being significant, but I would not have known that at the time.
So awesome. That's really great. So what was the job that they hired you for?
I got hired as an analyst, comma, linguistics.
Okay.
A very strong and descriptive title. Yes.
Awesome.
Practically speaking, what that meant is at Verilog, the thing that they primarily do is discourse analysis of doctor and patient dialogues mm-hmm. in an exam room. So I was one of the people, you know, boots on the ground, listening to these recordings and doing, you know, conversation and discourse analysis mm-hmm. on how the dyads and occasionally triads were operating. Mm-hmm. So when a physician says this, what is the patient actually taking away from it? Mm-hmm. What mm-hmm. is interesting to them? What is unclear? Is there anything that's really unique about the way that some physicians who are more successful talk about a particular product, or they educate their patients about a disease that less successful physicians could be trained to do? So kind of looking at those interactions and seeing where are the places that can be improved and what are some of the like best practices that would help someone to get there.
Were you also doing interviews with physicians and or patients?
Rarely. So the way that Verilog works is they really focus on that dialogue mm-hmm. as their object of study. When there are primary interviews, so, you know, you call someone and you have a phone interview or you have a video interview with them, you know, 45, 60 minutes, those tend to be rarer than they are at a lot of other healthcare communication companies mm-hmm. where that primary market research, that interview face-to-face with a human really is what you're doing all the time. You know, 20 hours of your week is spent interviewing and the other 20 hours are spent analyzing those mm-hmm, interviews. Mm-hmm. If you shifted those hours to be, I'm listening to dialogues and I'm analyzing those dialogues, that's a much closer match to the work that I was doing there.
And then what's the deliverable out of that that you're then presenting to the client, whoever that is?
I am sure that this is going to be a broken record to everyone else that works in a similar field. But the deliverable is a PowerPoint report.
Of course, yes.
PowerPoint is the language of business.
Yeah.
And it is incumbent on us as linguists to convert whatever medium of PowerPoint we had been taught for conference presentations, for, you know, teaching your lectures if you were a TA or an adjunct or a faculty member, into the form that is used in different business sectors mm-hmm. and finding a way to, you know, balance the, it is a Word document, but it's more interactive. And it's very carefully designed. And since it's PowerPoint, you can embed audio so they can hear for themselves mm-hmm. what this conversation sounds like. But yeah, long story short, it's a PowerPoint. It's a very mm-hmm. unique PowerPoint to this realm of business, but it is just a PowerPoint at the end mm-hmm. of the day.
Yeah. And it's very much like, as a linguist, when you're doing research, like, here's the data and here's what I found, and mm-hmm. what does this mean, right? Like that's the last part of it, is not just saying, here's what I found, but then actually drawing a conclusion. Sometimes it means, in my line of business anyway, it means making recommendations to the client, but sometimes not. Sometimes it's more just, here's what it means, you decide what you're going to do with it.
Yeah, I think one of the best kinds of summaries that I've heard of how we're supposed to talk about what influence linguistics has on this object of study, on whatever we're looking at, is the what is said, how it's said, and why it matters kind of framework that I think some of us were taught in graduate school, but folks like myself came to it a little bit too late, where it's anyone can tell you what's being said. You know, that's the book report of linguistics. That is, I am summarizing the content of the speech. How it's said is where the impact of a linguist really starts to be felt in the business environment, where you can go so much further than just, well, like they sound kind of unsure. Mm-hmm. You can go in and you can demonstrate with the words that they're using or their intonation contours or various patterns in their speech that indicate certainty, you know, epistemic marking. Mm-hmm. And then the hardest work, and the thing that I think took me at least 2 years before I had any competence in, is, well, how do I actually summarize that to someone mm-hmm. else mm-hmm. who doesn't care about epistemic marking?
Right,
who
right.
doesn't care yes. about intonation uh-huh. contour? How do I make this salient to them? How do I make it clear that, no, it's not just that they're talking about this in this way. It's that here's what this actually means to you. Here's how you can use it. Here's how this benefits you. Here are recommendations that I see being made to improve the conversation based on these shortcomings that I'm observing.
Totally. I feel like that's the thing that linguists get paid for, right? As you were saying, anybody can do some of parts one and two, but really it's linguists who can explain what you should be taking away from that. And I find that in just about every field that linguists are in, it's the why, explaining why yeah. it's important. And then usually further, what you can do about it, right? Like in your field, how can we improve this communication? How can we make the experience better? That's what the clients are paying for, right? Like, mm-hmm. as you said, they don't care about one and two very much. They want the number three, like, tell me how to make this better.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it.
So it's funny, when you were saying what your title was, I got very excited because it had the word linguistics in it, which doesn't happen very often, but appropriately used. I think more jobs should have linguistics in it. So you were at Verilog for a while and then you changed jobs. So can you talk a little bit about how that happened?
Yeah, I was at Verilog for about 3 years. And just as a little bit of inside baseball, the average time that someone spends at a single company in healthcare communication is between 2 and 3 years, mm-hmm. depending on the specific company's record. But it is very, very common to see folks traveling to another company after 2 to 3 years, which is probably how we all know each other. Mm-hmm. The community is small enough of linguists in general, and we all end up working with each other's current and former colleagues that our LinkedIn circles are, the Venn diagram is pretty much just a complete circle. Mm-hmm. So I was there for about 2 or 3 years just under 3 years. And as I was approaching, you know, two and a half years there, I started just opening myself up to what else is out there. If a recruiter reached out to me, always listen to hear what they have to say, you know, looking for the next thing that was going to interest me. Because in full transparency, I was trained as a mixed methods researcher, and at Verilog, I was primarily doing qualitative research, and I didn't have a lot of opportunity to stretch those other muscles. And it was starting to get a little stale. So I'm like, oh, you know, I could do this for a little while yet, but I would be interested to hear what else is out there. Mm-hmm. And I would open myself up to just learning. And I heard from a couple of recruiters. I listened to hear what else is out there. And probably about 6 months into just passively looking, one of my former colleagues who ended up at InVibe posted a job that was going to be available soon at InVibe Labs, where I'm currently at and have been at for about 4 years now, give or take 2 weeks. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is primarily qualitative, but mixed methods in about half of the projects. There's a firm mixed methods backbone, even to the qualitative research that's happening. They're a smaller company. They're still a startup. So there's a lot more opportunity for innovation and bringing in some of the tools that I liked using in academia, but didn't have an opportunity to use when I was at a company that had already matured. And I'm like, this is probably the most interesting one that I've seen the whole time. Mm-hmm. And it was the only company that I applied to in the whole time that I was just sitting there opening myself up. And I think that my passion for it and my interest for it is what carried me through the entire interview process, as it was another long and involved one with, you know, multiple interviews with people at every level of the company. Mm. And it also did what is rather typical, included like a practical examination of like, show me what you can do.
Oh, okay.
And it was a whole process. And I was so excited about the job the whole time that I had no problem, in addition to, you know, my normal day job, mm-hmm. doing all of this additional work to apply to it. And it worked out, and I'm very, very happy to be where I'm at.
Yeah. I love what you were saying about being open, right? I think that's a, what's the word? I was going to say a spiritual thing. That's not really what I mean, but it's more your vibe, right? Like you can, if you want to be open to things, you will see the opportunities, right? Versus mm-hmm. if you're, you know, cool with what you're doing and your head is sort of down and you're working, that's it. It's rare that stuff will come to you if you're not open to things coming to you. I know that sounds very secret-like, like you're manifesting these things, but it does make a difference if your attitude is, I am open to something different, or I am open to a change. I think you see the opportunities a little bit more clearly than if you're content where you are.
Yeah, I very, very much agree. And I hope that everyone is in a place where, you know, they have that flexibility of just, mm-hmm. I don't need it right now. I'm happy enough where I am. They don't have that urgency that makes job searching so much more challenging, so much more fraught, removes a lot of the pleasure that you can have from, you know, getting to know people who may be your colleagues, getting to know positions that are probably similar to the one you're going to have. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you only get that when you come at it with an attitude that's appropriate for it. Yeah. Otherwise, there's just that, you know, instrumental view of I need you for this, and that just doesn't really bode as well for landing at a company that's going to be people first, and that, as we said before, like it's going to be a place that you feel comfortable being with with more time than for more time than you're with your family.
Yeah. Just thinking about what you were saying, you know, of course, everybody knows that there have been so many layoffs, especially in the tech sector. And it just, you know, it goes in cycles, as it always does. People mm-hmm. get laid mm-hmm. off, then they get rehired and blah, blah, blah. And it sucks because a lot of people lose their jobs. But I think it's kind of good because you get used to the cycle once you've been out there long enough. And if you do get laid off, it helps you from panicking. Right? Because that's the worst thing that you can do when you're applying for a job is to be in full panic mode, because nobody wants to hire anybody who's in full panic mode. It's just not cool. So you get a little more blasé about it. And, you know, I'm not trying to downplay people's very real financial issues and the things that they need to do, but there is a certain amount of putting on a cool front when you're applying for jobs, even if you've just been laid off and you really need to get another job. Having that together presentation is really important to employers.
Yeah, I hate to say this, I hate to agree, but there is a real bias against someone who is perceived to be more desperate, which may just be how that person operates in general. Like it may be a factor of anxiety as much as financial stress. And it's a, as you said, like it's a real bit of self-positioning to keep your cool, to be that person that an employer wants to see as, you know, I'm cool, I'm collected, regardless of the circumstance. And, you know, no matter how many times you see those layoffs in October or in May, when, you know, everyone's generally getting laid off to meet financial deadlines, it's never easy. It's no matter how familiar you get, it's always rough.
And yeah.
Oh, it's always a challenge.
And I will say, because I'm the one who's always talking about, you know, let's normalize crying at work. You can have all that, but in the, like you were just saying, in the interview process, it works against you to project that feeling of desperation or precarity or anxiety. It's unfortunate that that's the way it is, but you have to be able to do a little bit of dissembling. Is that the right word? I don't know. Just putting up a more together front until you feel more secure in it. That's the way it is.
Yeah. I'll take dissembling. It feels like the right concept.
Yeah.
You know, as many millennials and Xers that are in jobs and are bringing their whole person to those jobs, there are still some circumstances where it's not yet okay to be your fully authentic self.
Yeah.
You're still a little bit of faking it until you make it.
Yeah.
And I think no place is that more obvious than in those initial interviews. And I would like to remind everyone listening, as you know, I heard on some of the earlier podcasts that like, this is very much a thing that goes both ways. You know, as good an impression as you're trying to make, they are trying to make just as good an impression. And we cannot trust ourselves and we cannot trust them sometimes.
Yep, exactly. So I'm so glad we got to talking about this. This wasn't on my list of things to talk about, but I think it's again, just talking about it is important. I sometimes hear that from people, especially within the LCL environment, like, how do you do it? How do you go out there and be all together? It's like, well, I'm not really in my real life. Like, that's just the way I present myself. And I've done it for a long time. So I'm really good at presenting myself like that. It doesn't mean I am like that. This is just my business persona that I'm putting on for clients. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm having a Zoom meeting with them at freaking 7 o'clock in the morning and I'm all cheerful and happy. It's like, I don't feel cheerful and happy, but that's the way I am when I have to talk to my clients.
Yeah, I feel that. I viscerally feel that. Anyone in healthcare communications work is very likely doing a lot of international business.
Mm-hmm.
And those 6 a.m. calls with, you know, Japan happen, and they happen fairly regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not want to necessarily be on and your chipper and best self that early, but it's part of the role.
Yeah.
And turning that person on and off is something of a skill that we all just have to develop as we go through this process of professionalizing and kind of exiting the academic environment where it's not okay to be the faculty member that shows up a little bit late, a little bit disheveled, but it's more acceptable than it would be in the business world in a lot of
totally.
Cases.
Yeah, that's a great example. Thank you for bringing that up. I love it. Let's talk about you. Your job title has listening and linguistics in it, which I find fascinating. Tell us what that means.
Oh my goodness, yes. And it's because we spend all day listening and doing linguistics on it.
Okay.
I feel like it's one of the more obvious, like on the nose titles that should never exist in this culture. And the reason that it does exist, and I'm so fortunate to have linguistics in my title, is that historically, everyone on the research team has been a trained linguist, either with a master's or a PhD. And we have always approached ourselves and the company as something that really is linguistics first. That what we bring, as you said, what we bring to the table as linguists, our ability to craft those insights, to give clients the implications and the recommendations that matter most to them, are really because we're linguists. Not necessarily because we are exposed to the medical side and the healthcare communication side, and we're experts on that, but that we know how people communicate. And as such, by listening to them and understanding what their nuances in that speech is, that we can give the client something that really is novel, something innovative, mm-hmm. something that they're not going to get anywhere else. That's the marketing kind of spin to it. Practically, I really do listen and do linguistics all day. We have a specific technology-based platform that makes data collection really, really easy. So I am back in the world of standard interviews, like a one-on-one style interview. But the main difference is we do all of our interviews pre-designed so that there's a single path. Everyone is exposed to the same thing in the exact same way. And instead of being 45 minutes to an hour, they're about 20 minutes. I generally refer to it as the world's most complicated voicemail, where someone okay. calls in, they call in, they hear a question read to them by a professional voice actor, and then they just record their own response to it. And we'll listen to everyone. So patients, their caregivers, physicians, insurance providers, pharmacists. If you have a stake in the healthcare ecosystem as it exists in the US or abroad, chances are I've listened to you and I've listened to you spill your heart about what you need, what encourages you to thrive, what helps, what hurts. So that after listening to all of that and bringing in my own external knowledge, my knowledge of linguistics, my knowledge of the medical landscape, I can convert that to something that our clients are going to be interested in and feel has value, like direct value on whatever strategy they're trying to enact in their own lives, in their own business needs.
Wow, very cool. Do you work on a team? Do you work mostly by yourself? How's that go?
I work on a team, and I am very, very grateful for that. As one of the reasons that I started to realize that academia was not a good fit for me was the relative infrequency that I got to work on a team, like in a real collaborative environment. Not, I need a little help here or there, but here we are, two equals bouncing ideas off of each other to develop the best bit of research and executing it in the way that relies on both of our strengths. So in my professional environment, I work in a small team. It's usually between two and four people on a project, depending on the size of the project. And that really just enables us to push each other as we're going through, because everyone's listening to all of the interviews. You're saying what you hear, they're saying what they hear, and then together you kind of build a story based on the data that you have, and then you divide and, meet back again to see how well you're each telling your individual parts of that story. And you kind of work collaboratively back and forth like that, coming together with like, oh, here I am with my notes after I've listened to everything. Mm-hmm. Here I am with my second pass notes, and here I am with my first draft of that PowerPoint report. And, go away, come back, go away, come back, meet as needed, to get out of your head enough that by the end of the day, you can, or by the end of the week, more likely, if we're talking actual time scales, by the end of the week, you can come to your client with something that without having listened to any of the interviews, mm-hmm. they will have a real sense of what those folks have communicated, what needs they have, and what they recommend for themselves and what you recommend for them.
That's great. I want to introduce a word here, which I may have said before, but which I think is a good business speak for people to know, which is this word actionable, right?
Like, yes.
That's the word that gets thrown around a lot. And what actionable means is literally that the client can take action with it, right? So to give an example from my own work, when I'm doing a linguistic analysis for a client and I do a survey and I figure out if the names that they're trying to choose for their product have a meaning that is undesirable in a language other than English, I can present them with all that information, but the actionable part is me going, and therefore I think you should not proceed with this name, right? Like that's the action part of it. I could give them reams and reams of etymology and usage and quotes and stuff, but unless there's a bullet point at the end that says, and therefore, it's not really worth it to them because they're not, frankly, going to take the time to go through all that. They just flip to the page in the PowerPoint that has the, and here's our recommendations. I suspect it works similarly for you guys.
I would agree with all of that, 1,000%. It's it's a very action-driven kind of industry, even though it positions itself as an insights-driven industry.
Yeah, yeah.
That the research agencies may be doing a lot of research. They may be generating a lot of insights. But if you think about how many projects we have ongoing at any given time, the people that we are reporting to probably have 3 or 4 times that going at the same time.
Yeah.
So as much as I would like to say that we're just so smart on the research side and we can figure all this out and then we have to dumb it down and distill it for our clients, the truth of the matter is, you know, we are doing them the service of doing all of the work and building that rapport, building that faith in us that they trust that we've done all of the work.
Yes, yeah.
And then they can take the actions that we recommend. And I love your definition of actionable, by the way. I always just think about it of like, okay, and then what?
Right, and right. Yes, it's exactly what it is. Like, and then what? Yeah, what am I supposed to do with this? Yeah. It's so important, and it's a skill that, speaking personally, I had to learn, right? So in academia, there's no actionable part that comes at the end. Like you do your research and you put it together and you go, here's this very interesting thing that I found. And then when you are suddenly in a business context, it has to mean something. Like that's what they're mm-hmm. paying you for, is to like say, yeah, what's next? What does it mean? What do we do with this information? And it took a long time for me to feel comfortable doing that because, of course, as an academic, you're always hedging, right? Well, it could mean this, or maybe you should do that. And you can't do that. Like you have to develop your skills as a recommender to say, here's really what we should be doing. And it takes time to do it. But it's, for me, it was a huge shift from the academic viewpoint of I am just objectively reporting on this to here's what I think you should be doing. And like you just said, you should trust me that my recommendation is a good one because I'm an expert and I've been doing this and I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And I think to continue that positive kind of framing for it, it's a really heartening difference between academia and what I see in my business life now, where no matter what I did and what I recommended that teachers do based on, you know, some of the second language acquisition theory that I had been testing, or no matter how many times I evaluated a specific lesson plan or a specific set of exercises and then reported that out into the world at a conference or in a paper, how many people that are going to need to see that are actually mm-hmm. going to see it?
Yeah.
And In the business world, I'm communicating directly to the person that's going to take action on it. Mm-hmm. Like there's a very discrete time horizon where I can see from the time that I make a recommendation to the time that I see that recommendation either online or in a magazine or on TV mm-hmm. or in, you know, the next round of the FDA guidelines on some topic. And that difference in impact and impactfulness of the work, I think is a thing that really can't be understated as a real clear benefit, a motivator, something that's really exciting about the work that we have the privilege of doing.
Yeah, totally agree. I love seeing my work out there in the world and seeing it make a difference, whether it's big or small. One other thing I just came to mind as you were talking is that, especially about that trust issue, which I think is so well stated and super important. I see a lot of talk on the internet, you know, oh, AI is coming for your jobs. And people have asked me, like, do you think AI is going to replace linguists doing X, Y, and Z? And the answer is no, of course not. A lot of what people say AI, large language models, can do is the kind of work that you were talking about. Like, let's look at all these pieces of data with people interacting and then make a recommendation on it. Like, how can we improve things? And the point of linguists over AI is that you can never trust AI, right? You could never, ever trust its conclusions that it is drawing from this because it's not human. It doesn't have any intelligence. It can only predict based on what's been put into it. So the kinds of insights that you as a linguist come up with is never going to happen from AI. It just won't.
Yeah, I very, very much agree. I have never really felt that my job was in jeopardy. I am not going to curse on this podcast for it to be censored later, but my opinions of a lot of the AI tools and a lot of the hype for AI are really captured in Harry Frank's 2005 book, that if you're interested in looking up what the title of it is or what the subject matter is, it's on a particular topic that's related to bovine excrement. That as it is a linguistic category. And I would say, though, that I am much more bullish, to keep the metaphor alive, on the ways that we can use AI to help us to do some of the things that used to be frustrating manual tasks. That it excels at, because it is just a bag of words that's pulling things based on stats. What that you would be doing as a statistically oriented analyst to just count stuff and regurgitate it, that it can do faster and more easily and more accurately, perhaps, than you can. Yep. And I love those tools. I'm very excited about those.
I completely agree. Yeah, tools. Tools is what it is. I think this was prompted because I was just reading an article about how bad AI is at summarizing things. Like, because it doesn't know what the important stuff is to pull out as part of the summary. So even using it to perhaps summarize a long interview is still going to be worthless because it won't know what to pick out that's important. It's only looking for, you know, occurrence of words or whatever in its previous database. Anyway, I didn't want to get off track there, but it is something that has been coming up more and more because it's like what we do is language, and people somehow have this idea that because AI is literally a large language model, it's going to somehow be doing all this linguistic stuff that linguists do. And that is not true.
Yeah, it's just not.
It just isn't. I don't know how to explain it better than that, but okay. So to round this off, so you're at your job, you've been here for a while. It looks like you've had a couple of promotions. So internally, you've risen up through the ranks. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Is that great?
I mean, it is great. I love it. I think one of the things for folks to know in this industry, that your title doesn't always reflect your job responsibilities and what you're doing and what changes. But more accurately, like, the proportion of things that you do may change. So I still do all of the same tasks that I did, like, analytically and reporting wise, that I did, you know, 7-8 years ago when I first started at Verilog, where I go through, I listen to all of the data, I report it out. But I also now have the privilege of someone who is more experienced on this to spend more time finding ways to innovate or finding more ways to coach my team members. And if anything, I think as titles have changed and as I've grown in my career and that balance has shifted, I've really learned that I love the opportunity to kind of mentor folks who are more junior in their mm-hmm. careers, build up their skills so that they, when they are eventually promoted or when they end up at their next gig, that they feel somewhere in the back of their head, there's the voice that says, you know, you're good at this. Mm-hmm. You can do mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. You know how to do it. You've been doing it. And this other 20% that you're not so good at yet, you can probably figure out because you figured out everything else. And I hope that's the kind of manager that I've been able to grow into over the last 4 or 5 years. But it's certainly one of the things that excites me most about my day-to-day when I'm not doing research. Mm-hmm. I get to support others as they do theirs.
That's great. And I'm guessing some of them are linguists.
I would say all of them. Yeah, everyone everyone is a linguist.
Oh, that's awesome. One of the things I love about talking to linguists in industry is that almost everybody is an evangelist for linguists in industry, right? So we get in and then it's like, let's hire more of us because we're awesome at what we do.
Yeah, and I think it's well-founded. You know, it's not just us. Yeah. It's not just us tooting our own horn. Although, of course, one of us would say that. But there really is something unique about a linguistics training, be it a generalist training or in any of the specific subspecialties, that prepares someone for work that is either like cognitive science oriented or behavioral science oriented. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. trying to understand how people think or trying to understand why people do what they do. Just because all of that is always mediated by language, our perspective and our ability to understand someone and just empathize with them, mm-hmm. listen and like really actively listen, understand where they're coming from, gives us a leg up over folks who are just thinking of it from a more nuts and bolts kind of perspective of like, mm-hmm. here I am trying to understand what this person needs to do because I have a specific set of objectives that I need to understand at the end of the day, and approaching it much more instrumentally, where I think the passion that we bring to it and the expertise that our education has provided us just makes our work stand out and makes it fresher and more rich than I see in some of my competitors when I have the privilege of seeing some of their work. I don't see that there. Like, I don't see the life. I don't see the authenticity. Mm-hmm. I don't see the real representation of who those people are. But I've always seen it when it's a linguist who's writing that report, even at a competitive agency.
Yep. That's great. That's a wonderful sentiment. And I think it applies not only in your business, but in just about every business where you have linguists. I like that word, the authenticity of the linguist is just super important. And then that's what builds the trust with the people mm-hmm. who are paying you for your expertise, right? Like, you're authentic, you're the expert, and then they trust you. And that's where business relationships are meant to go.
Yeah, I 100%. Agree. I think that by just being ourselves and by applying the rigor to language that we've been trained to apply mm-hmm. to it and the passion that we all have that drove us, however circuitously, into linguistics in the first place, it does a lot of the work for us. Like, it builds a lot of the credibility. It builds a lot of the rapport and it makes everything else easy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I think that about wraps it up. Christopher, is it okay for people to contact you on LinkedIn if they want to know more about your work or if they just want to get in touch?
Absolutely. I am always open to folks reaching out on LinkedIn. I was fortunate enough to benefit from the generosity of others as I was transitioning out of an academic environment into the business world. So I'm happy to connect. I'm happy to do informational interviews. Virtual coffees are always great. Mm-hmm. And please, please reach out. I would not be offering if it weren't sincere.
That's awesome. Thank you again for your time. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you, Laurel. I have had the best time talking with you today.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held 2 online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.